salad on. Two-thirds a person. Rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on blatant denial. Squeezed economics, subsistence survival. Deafening silence and social control. Black rage is found in all wounds in the soul. When the dogs bite, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so bad. Black rage is founded, fed us self-hatred. Lies and abuse, while we waited and waited. Spiritual treason, this grid and its cages. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on training and training. Finding your freedom, stop your complaining. Poisoning your water while they say it's raining. Are you mad for complaining, complaining? Old top bureaucracy, drugging the youth. Black rage is founded on blocking the truth. Murder and crime, compromise and distortion. Sacrifice, sacrifice, who makes this fortune? Greed falsely called progress, such human contortion. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things. All these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so bad. Friends of pride, is it myth or illusion? Forcing you back into purpose confusion. Like human trafficking or blood transfusion. Black rage is founded on these kinds of things.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, here in the Great White North. And we kick the show off with the music of Lauryn Hill. And Lauryn Hill did a piece called Black Rage. But before I talk about that, I'd like to talk about Uhuru Radio. I would like to thank Omali Ishitella, Chairman Omali Ishitella, and Archie Shep, two gentlemen from Florida. Chairman Omali Ishitella gave me the space to do Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and Diasporic Music, the name Diasporic Music, pardon me, was given to me by Archie Shep. Diasporic Music is music made in the West, but not of the West. African music made by people who have been taken out of Africa. And, you know, diasporic music is reggae. Diasporic music is blues. Diasporic music is calypso. It's zouk. It's samba. All the forms of music that we created outside of Africa. But we cheat and play music that was made in Africa itself. We love music from the African continent as well. But we have a lot of exciting shows on Uhuru Radio. We want you to listen to Omali Ishatella Speaks. So we want you to listen to Africa Live with D-Don Santero. We want you to listen to Reparations in Action with with Penny Hess, Golden Sunday Sounds, and Caribbean Forum. Ron Bob Simple is so nice, we have to listen to him twice. And of course, we want you to listen to Black Agenda Report or Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. And that song, My Favorite Things by Lauryn Hill, was Rodgers and Hammerstein's song, believe it or not. It's from the sound of music, I believe. And Lauryn Hill, I've always liked Lauryn Hill because she knows music. And when I heard the Fugees do the song that they did where they sampled I Only Have Eyes for You by the Flamingos, I think that came out in 1957. I was hooked on the Fugees and Lauryn Hill. But my favorite things was a Coltrane. Was a song that John William Coltrane did in 1961, and it was the first album that featured Coltrane playing soprano saxophone, and it was in 1998. It was the album was a recipient of a Grammy Hall of Fame award, and we want to listen to the original My Favorite Thing. This is John William Coltrane. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nangadef. Nangadef is a language of Wolof, and they speak Wolof in Senegal, the Gambia, and parts of Mauritania. And it is a greeting in the Wolof language, and I'd like to send that out to all of the Wolof listeners. And we were listening to John William Coltrane, and he did My Favorite Things. And we have a very action-packed show for you today. We're going to be speaking with Melinda Francis. Melinda Francis is the director of the festival director of Caribbean Tales International Film Festival, and also she's director at Diaspora Travels Haiti, and she's an owner and filmmaker at Docu Vixen Films. And we're also going to be speaking with the OG, the original gorilla, Kilo and Yasha. And we will be speaking with Kilo around 3:30. And I was looking at Facebook, and I see that Palestine is supporting Ferguson. And there was a page 2 article in the Toronto Star today about Ferguson. And I know that Chairman O'Malley Ishitella and Chairwoman Penny Hess are in Ferguson. And stay tuned to Uhuru Radio. And we have updates constantly, videos, articles, and so on and so forth. But right now, we want to go to Brazil. And there's a group called Olodum out of Brazil. And this is a real Pan-African song that we're going to play. It's written by Jimmy Cliff. And they capture the whole African world, from Trenchtown to Watts, from Brazil to Brixton. And let's give it a listen. They mentioned the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, and many, many others. This is from Brazil.
Oh, cry. No, woman, no cry. No, woman, no cry. No, woman, no cry. Bem que eu me lembro da gente sentada ali na grama do adeus, sob o sol, observando hipócritas disfarçados rondando ao redor, amigos presos, amigos sumindo assim, oi, 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 ah, pra nunca mais. Tais recordações, retratos do mal em si, melhor é deixar pra trás. Cante comigo.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, and we were listening to music from Brazil, Gilberto Gil, who was once the Minister of Culture of Brazil, and I was reading his story, and he was actually jailed for a number of years. I guess they jailed everyone from Jesus Christ to Martin Luther King. Kwame Ture went to jail, I don't know, many, many, many times, but Gilberto Gil did Bob Marley's No Woman, No Cry in Portuguese, and we also listened to a group out of Brazil doing a Jimmy Cliff song, and we are joined on the line by Melinda Francis, the festival director at Caribbean Tales International Film Festival, and also she is the director at Diasporic Travels Haiti, and she is the owner, filmmaker, at DocuVexen Film, and we work together at Radio Region and do a number of things together, and for, I guess, full disclosure, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing good. You know, I'm still here. It's pretty hectic at the festival right now, so...
it looks like you seem like a one-legged woman in a butt-kicking contest.
Yes, something like that.
Yeah, because I know it's been very difficult. You've been really. I know you've been busy.
Yeah, it's you know, it's running a festival and it's not easy.
Now, Caribbean Tales, is this the Caribbean Tales annual International Film Festival will showcase films from 15 different countries around the region with public, community, and online screenings, including 10 feature-length and 20 short films. And there'll be music, culture, indigenous, Caribbean politics, poetry, sexuality, and spirituality. And you can visit caribbeantales.com/events. Let me get that right. caribbeantales-events www.thebeatsandthebeats.com, and you can get your complete listings, correct?
Yes, you can. And you could, if you're in Toronto, you can buy tickets. There's a link to buy tickets. And all the schedule at a glance, so you can look at that. This year we're actually offering a festival pass, so if people want to see the whole gamut, we encourage people to actually support the festival and come to all the films. There's something for everybody.
How much is a pass for the whole night, for the whole film festival?
It's $100 for your pass right now. So
for everything.
It's pretty
affordable.
Yeah, it's pretty affordable for the closing, for the opening and closing and all the screenings. Yeah. So.
Okay. Now, this is the Caribbean. Now, this is not the West Indian Film Festival. So many people talk about the Caribbean, we're talking about English-speaking countries, French-speaking countries, Spanish-speaking countries, Dutch-speaking countries, and I believe the ABC countries speak Papiamento and Dutch, you know.
Yep.
But could you talk about why Caribbean as opposed to just West Indian?
I think our goal at the Caribbean, at Caribbean Tales, is to explore what it means to come from a voice that is Caribbean and sort of exploring what that is. And that means anywhere, not just actually in the region, but it also is, international. So wherever Caribbean people have gone or are from, that is included within the Caribbean. So it's not just actually people who live in the region, but it's people who, where they came from. So whether it's, people who came from Africa or South Asia or where Caribbean go. So if they migrate to, the UK or Canada, it's wherever Caribbean people are, is actually the Caribbean. If that makes sense. I don't know if that makes sense. Yes.
Oh, yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
So we say that Caribbean is of the world. It's not a place.
Now, could you talk about the opening night at the Royal? Could you talk about the film that you're going to show and what's going to take place at the opening of the film festival?
Yeah, so our opening is coming up. It's on the Wednesday, September 3rd, and it is featuring a film called The Glamour Boys, Sparrow, and Superior on the Hilton Rooftop, and it's a follow-up film of Jeffrey Dunn's Calypso Dreams, and it's around Sparrow and Sparrow and Lord Superior. We are happy to honor and invite Sparrow, and he will be in attendance at the Q&A on Wednesday. So it's pretty exciting. We encourage everybody to come to the reception. It's our opening reception as well. So get introduced to the festival, watch a couple of films, network with people, and, join us for the Q&A with the mighty Sparrow himself in attendance. It's
going to
be exciting.
Now, The Mighty Sparrow was actually born in Grenada, and there's another film you're showing called Forward Ever. It's about the Grenada Revolution, and Maurice Bishop was born in Aruba, which was a colonized by the Dutch, and I guess we're going just to show the imperialism, how imperialism, affected colonial people. And I guess another thing I wanted to ask you, you know, about those two things, but, you know, Sparrow coming from being born in Grenada and Morris being born, Prime Minister Bishop being born in Aruba. But I think we also should talk about the fact that the Caribbean is, there's a multiracial society, as opposed to it's not African, just African or just Indian, and it's more than just African and Indian. So those are two questions here.
Well, it's basically the Caribbean, way before Canada has coined the multiculturalism, has been a multicultural experience since contact, really. So, there has been migration through the region for as long as it's been a region. Even before the Europeans came, it was, the indigenous people moved from island to island. That's the sort of like the history of the region. I would like to, think about when I was in Barbados last, a couple of years ago, I was with my aunt, and we were at her work, and it was like one of her last days, but we were hanging out with her coworkers and basically going around of, where people were from, and most of them were either, Vincentian Bajan or Canadian Bajan. You know what I'm saying? There was always, people have roots all over the region. It's not just in one place. And that's sort of like the makeup that is kind of lost sometimes in, national colonial context.
Well, I was reading Stokely Carmichael's Cormac Turpin's autobiography, and he talked about his mother being born from Panama, his grandfather being from Barbados, and someone else being from Antigua. I mean, that is that's kind of normal when you deal with Caribbean people, would you say?
Yes. people are from the region. So I don't know, for me, it's I'm pretty, pan-Caribbean, or I kind of rep the whole region. It's not in a national kind of context, so that's why I was drawn to Caribbean tales in general. So,
well, I have a question for you. I didn't see any film from Cuba in the film festival, and I'm wondering, there's a lot of, Cuba's under, is being isolated by U.S., but I mean, they have the support of basically most of the world. But what's happening with the film industry in Cuba?
Well, that was actually one of our pushes to actually sort of connect with the Cuban, Cuban film, because reason why we wanted to connect with them is because they have a long-standing film tradition. So that is one of our works. I was able to sort of, I wanted to actually do a short program, but, because of time, I wasn't able to sort of develop those partnerships fully. So, but that is, what we're trying to do in the future, to actually include, because not only do they have a long standing tradition within the Caribbean, we have a lot to learn from Cuban filmmakers. So, unfortunately, I wasn't able to kind of explore and get as many films, or it didn't fit into our program. That is sort of what we want to do in the future, is connect and build with Cuban filmmakers, because of their long-standing film tradition within the region, and the region as a whole can actually learn from that and sort of build on that. What we are doing this year is sort of reaching out to sort of been, you know, film commission to come to our festival and hopefully build a partnership with them.
I'm speaking.
If that makes sense. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So that is like one of our thing. And there's also a lot of people or a lot of you know, Caribbean. I know, like, one of our incubatees who was in the incubator is going to school in Cuba because they have a really good film program there. So a lot of people from the Caribbean actually go to their film school. So yeah.
I'm speaking with Melinda Francis, the festival director at the Caribbean Tales International Film Festival. And could you talk about the state of filmmaking here in not just Toronto, but in Canada? How does that look in terms of how is that developing?
And specifically in with Caribbean film or
Caribbean
or
in Caribbean films.
Mm-hmm. I think across the there's more and more film that's coming out, and that is just because people have more access to it. And I think there has to be like a lot of sort of fostering, and we're in sort of like an incubator, I think, where the the Canadian film industry was about in Canada here locally in the 70s is where the Caribbean is now. So it's sort of like this push where people are just making content and it's exciting, but it's like there's going to be a lot of work in sort of building an infrastructure and supporting people to continually build the industry within the region, but also capacity amongst filmmakers and producers and sort of, like building sort of networks. And so that's where we're at. Like, I think we're in a really exciting time where people want to actually make stuff. So that's exciting.
Now, Caribbean films, could you talk about Caribbean film festivals in other parts of the world? Do they have Caribbean film festivals in New York and in the Caribbean states? Because they would have to. Just interested to just give people some support if people are doing things.
I know that like Trinidad has a film festival. Belize has a film festival.
Belize, the film festival.
They have, I believe that there's one in Aruba. So they're kind of popping up in various places. Trinidad and Tobago's International Film Festival is pretty big. So I think the more festivals there are, the better. Not only is because it's creating sort of a culture of watching certain content, which is important, and building audiences within the region, so that when we make them, we have somebody to show them to. I think that's the role of festivals, is that the more festivals there are, you're sort of building that culture of watching films that is not Hollywood.
Now, film making films is a very serious project in terms of raising money. It's harder to make a film than it is to record a CD or an album. How is the funding for Canadian and Caribbean films in how does that work, and is it, how challenging is that in 2014?
it's pretty challenging. I guess talk about the incubator. So
Okay, yeah, talk about what is the incubator? Yes, we need to hear
incubator, there's three facets to the Caribbean Tales International Film Festival. There's one, building audience, which is sort of building a culture of the audience sort of coming to watch our content, because, you know, we have sort of like this addiction to certain content, you know, which is not our own, from our own lens. So it's sort of building, you know, audience within our own communities to watch our stories. So that's what we do the community screening for, where we go into communities and we basically show our content and hopefully, you know, people will kind of sort of be interested. Then there's a second facet, which is the market incubator, where we support and build capacity with amongst our producers and our directors and people making films. So what it is, it's like a 5-day sort of boot camp of being able to package your films and market it to the international market. So being able to pitch your project, to get financing, to get support for your film, to get distribution for your film, or distribute yourself, however it kind of makes sense for your film. So it's a 4-day, 5-day process where you kind of, it's like a sort of a producer's kind of boot camp, and then it ends with a pitch where you have to pitch your project to a whole bunch of people on the 7th. So that's like basically our sort of, support in building capacity amongst our creators, but also sort of building infrastructure for industry within the region. And then the festival itself is sort of marketing and showcasing our stories. So creating amongst the wider society of, you know, seeing our films, kind of thing. So to go back to your question about how hard it is to actually make a film, I think people don't even know like the half of it, because it's like when I first came into the filmmaking, you know, your focus is on making of the film. So and then perfecting the craft of making a film. But then once you finish it, there's a whole other kind of set of things of actually getting your film seen. So basically that's what the incubator is opening that for people who are making films to say, oh, well, that's not all you have to think about. You have to think about, where is it going to go? How are you going to get it to an audience? How are you going to sort of get it, get the resources to make your film, but also distribute it and get it to people.
Right. Now, so Glamour Boys, again, is going to be, that is the opening film, and that's going to be at the Royal Cinema for people in Toronto. That's at 608 College Street. And I guess it's going to have the Mighty Sparrow, Lord Superior, and this is basically dealing with the Calypso idiom. Does this film feature any of the women Calypsonians, or just these are just the male giants and the pioneers?
Sorry. So you're saying about the actual film, like the Glamour Boys?
It's the Glamour Boys, so I guess it is.
It's a focus on Superior and...
Superior and Sparrow. I got you.
Sparrow, yeah.
Yeah. I have you. Mm-hmm.
The Glamour Boys, yeah. It's a follow-up from Calypso Dreams.
I saw Calypso Dreams, right.
Yeah, it's a follow-up film of that film.
Calypso Dreams was it is a great film. I'm looking forward to seeing that film, because a friend of mine from Antigua gave me, when I first moved to Canada, he gave me an album with Sparrow saying Castro eating the banana and Martin Luther King for president. That was in, I think he did that in the 60s, but I don't know if Sparrow did the first song about Martin Luther King or Duke Ellington, because Sparrow did, he did a song called Martin Luther King for President, and Duke Ellington did a song called Bam about Alabama, talking about Martin Luther King. But Sparrow has been in the, I guess, the forefront of a lot of struggles. How do you feel? We only have a few minutes left, but how do you feel young people, young Caribbean people, and young African people feel about Sparrow? Or is Sparrow an oldie but goodie? Is he just known by older Caribbean people, or does he have a following among everybody?
I think it depends on the context. I think if you're from the region, I think it's pretty widespread. The Sparrow is pretty much a staple. And I guess I'm kind of in a name that, like, I'm not a young person anymore. So I might not be the best person, but I think, you know, amongst, you know, the Trinidadian community, it's pretty much, you know, widespread throughout the community about Sparrow. So, and I mean, I grew up with him, so I don't, I guess I don't know on the pulse, so it would be interesting for me and actually to see who comes out. And I suspect that it is sort of a, you know, a generational thing. But I guess it's something that I would have to see. I'm excited to see, like, the demographics of who come out to see the film. But, I guess I'm saying that, yeah, I don't know. Like, I know whoever, you know, basically in my circle, everybody knows who Sparrow is.
I remember the Biko Rodney Malcolm Coalition, presenting Sparrow, pardon me, with an award for refusing to perform in South Africa, and they gave me the assignment to do it. And I remember walking on stage, and they had to stop the show. And I didn't know whether or not I was going to get off the stage alive, you know. And I remember we presented the award, and, you know, I walked off stage, and there was an elder, much older than me, woman, a Jamaican woman, and she was laughing and saying, "Keep up your good work, you know, it's like, you know, this is people are partying, but, you know, we really appreciate, and I appreciate, you know, what your group is trying to do, because Sparrow deserves the, you know, the award for refusing to perform in South Africa." So she was basically just setting me down and laughed and said, you know, don't let these folks get to you, because of, you know, they're full of rum and so on and so forth. But what you guys are doing is good, because Sparrow should be honored for his political work. You know, I never will forget that.
He is, like, as people have been saying, like, around my, you know, going about promoting the festival, is that he is a national, like, treasure. So, it's so I encourage people to come out, because, you know, we don't know, you know, not to be morbid, but we don't know how long he had with him. So it's important to hear from him, you know?
We only have 3 minutes left. Is there anything you would like to add? because we will talk again. But
If people want to get more information about the festival, go to CaribbeanTales-Events.com. If you're in Toronto and you need more information around tickets, you can call the festival at 647-533-6443. If you want to connect to the festival, if you're interested in the festival and you want to build with the festival, please email me at CaribbeanTales@gmail.com. We're always looking for people to sort of build with. So, contact me. If you have and look out for calls for submissions this year. We're going to start really early, so connect with us and stay tuned on when we build towards our next year, which is our 10th anniversary. So, just hit us up and connect, and we'll be happy to work with people.
And thank you very much for coming on Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we will see you Wednesday night, if not before.
Okay, cool. Thank you, Noam, again.
All right, take care.
Bye.
And we have been speaking with Melinda Francis of Caribbean, Caribbean filmmaker and Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio continues.
Voice of the International African Revolution.
Hey, Aisha, hold on. I'll walk with you. You know, this is going to be a great class.
I know. Yet I'm still trying to figure out how I can exactly use these skills.
The Uhuru Movement.
The Uhuru Movement?
Yes, the Uhuru Movement. They offer great opportunities to utilize these type of skills in the most meaningful ways. I mean, writers, photography, graphic design, journalism, videography, video editing, even radio broadcasting.
Wow, sounds great. I'm assuming you have to be pretty advanced.
Not at all. I mean, although experienced is welcome, it's not mandatory. You know, the Uhuru Movement, they will train you. Log on and sign up today at uhurunews.com, where your skills are wanted and needed. Whether reporting on local news, writing for an international newspaper, or hosting your own radio show, the Uhuru Movement is the place for you. Do you have a desire to work in sales, marketing, or administration? Do you have the talent for audio engineering? Log on and sign up today, uhurunews.com. Not just explaining the world, but changing the world.
Thank you, brother. I will definitely follow up to that.
And hopefully you'll become a member like I am.
Ananga Death, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond. We have just spoke to Melinda Francis. We're going to be speaking to Kilu and Yasha. And right now, we want to pay tribute to Sarita Wright Mohammed. Sarita Wright Mohammed was a Grammy-nominated African singer-songwriter, and she's best known for her work with her ex-husband Stevie Wonder and Billy Preston. And we want to present the music of Sarita Wright Mohammed.
Coming down.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. You're listening to Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, the bluesologist based in the Great White North here in Toronto, Canada. We are paying tribute to Sherita Wright Muhammad. Sherita was born, Sherita Wright, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, 1946, and started singing at age four. Her father died while serving in the Korean War. And Sherita and her two sisters, Yvonne and Kim, were raised by their mother and their grandmother. The Wrights moved back and forth from Detroit to South Carolina before settling in Detroit just as Sherita entered high school. Money problems kept Sherita from pursuing a career in ballet, so Sherita focused her attention on a music career, joining several singing groups before landing a job as a receptionist at Motown in 1965. Within a year, she became a secretary for Mickey Stevens, just as Martha Reeves had done before her. And Sherita married Stevie Wonder, and we're going to play two selections that they wrote with Lee Garrett. Lee Garrett, Stevie Wonder, and Sherita Wright wrote the next song that we're going to play, and the lead singer of this song is G.C. Cameron. G.C. Cameron was the lead singer of the Temptations and the Spinners, but G.C. Cameron is used to be part of the royal family. He married one of the Gordy sisters, but this is G.C. Cameron, one of the greatest vocalist out there today, and he hit some million-dollar notes on It's a Shame. So let's listen to The Spinners with G.C. Cameron, and this song is from the pen of Sherita Wright Muhammad, Stevie Wonder, and Lee Garrett.
It's a shame the way you mess around with the man.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to The Spinners featuring the voice of G.C. Cameron, still in the land of the living, and Bobby Smith, who is no longer with us. Purvis Jackson, the bass man, he's no longer with us. And Bobby Smith, I don't know if I mentioned him already, but he's no longer with us. And I think Henry Frambrome is still in the land of the living, and he's still living, still leading a group of spinners in 2014. And G.C. Cameron left Spinners because he stayed with Motown. He was married to one of Berry Gordy's sisters, and he left the Spinners, stayed with Motown, and the Spinners moved to Atlantic Records, and as they say, they picked up Felipe Wynn, and the rest is history. G.C. Cameron stayed with Motown, and we want to play G.C. and Sarita. They put G.C. Cameron and Sarita together, and Sarita was married to Stevie at that particular time. And this is a beautiful song, a beautiful ballad by G.C. Cameron and Sarita Wright, called I Want to Be by Your Side. This is from the pen of the eighth wonder of the world, Stevie.
beautiful. Oh, I think you should be by my side to stay right.
Come give me your sweetness. How there's you there To know you is to love you, but to know me is not that way, you see. Yet you made me so happy that my love for you grows endlessly. When I am sad and feeling down, you always comfort me. When I am sad and feeling down, you always comfort me.
To know you is to love you, is to see you be as free as the wind. Yeah. For the power of your love is too strong.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Richmond, and we have been listening to the music of Syreeta Wright. We were listening to Syreeta and Stevie Wonder. They did a song called To Know You Is To Love You. We also heard Billy Preston and Syreeta do With You, I'm Born Again. They did that live in 1980. And G.C. Cameron and Syreeta did I Want to Be By Your Side. Joining us on the line from San Francisco, California, is Kilo Inyasha, a revolutionary journalist, and she is currently the host of Freedom is a Constant Struggle. And we would like to welcome Kilo Inyasha to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Norman. It's so good to be with you, and thank you so much for having me on your program.
Well, this is Black August, and this is the last day of Black August, and we had you on last year to talk about Black August, and we basically wanted to continue our tradition. And, Black August is, people are talking about Black August in the United States and Canada, South Africa, Cuba, it is Japan. It is
right.
Really it seems to have taken off.
Yeah, it took root, didn't it, and blossomed. Yes, I'm very pleased to see that, too, because it's the time of year that we honor our heroes and sheroes and commemorate our revolutionary struggles, our revolutionary martyrs, and it's good to remember and focus on wonderful history of resistance that we blacks have. As opposed to the constant denigration of our people over the airwaves, painting us to be nothing more than criminals. So I think it's Black August is taking on a very great significance annually in its power to educate our youth and to raise their consciousness about our heroic history.
Could you give us a history of Qatari Galvin, George Jackson, and Jonathan Jackson? I think these are the three people that the Black August is based around. So I guess you would start with Jonathan, then George, and then Qatari Galvin, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Well, we can't talk about Jonathan without talking about George. Jonathan Jackson was George Lester Jackson's younger brother, who was 17 years old, and a student of his brilliantly scholarly Soledad brother, George Jackson, who had done about 11 years by 1970. For a $70 gas station robbery, that he didn't commit, but was driving the car, and was the person who actually did the robbery got out 2 years later, but he was given an indeterminate sentence, and was continuously denied parole. But of course, it's very important to say that when George, as he pointed out, when he arrived at San Quentin, that's where he met Marx, Engels, Mao, and began his studies in studying economics, studied scientific socialism, dialectical materialism, etc., and became a prison leader one of the leaders of the brothers who stood up against the blatant racism and targeting of blacks. The terrorizing of blacks back in the 60s and what they called the Black Movement. And, of course, George eventually became the field lieutenant of the Black Panther Party. He caught a case in 1971 following the blatant murder of three of the black members of the Black Movement. W.L. Nolan, excuse me, who was one of the leaders, alongside George and a brother they called Sweet Jug Miller and another brother, Cleve Edwards, was shot down on the yard of Soledad Prison in January of 1970. And the brothers tried to get justice, and of course they were rendered a the prison guard who blatantly murdered them, and then they were left to bleed to death on the yard, similarly to the way we've seen Michael Brown and other young black men shot on the streets and left to bleed to death. So they couldn't get justice. It was, you know, justifiable homicide, the usual verdict, and so the prisoners, some prisoners took matters into their own hands, and a guard was thrown off, beaten and thrown off a tier. Three brothers caught the case, Fleeta Drumgo, John Cluche, and George Jackson, and actually they were eventually acquitted Pope after George's death on August 21, 1970. But Jonathan, getting back to Jonathan Jackson, demanded the release of the Soledad brother through a military action that was planned with James McLean and William Christmas, two of the other revolutionary brothers, who McLean was on trial at the time at the Marin Courthouse in Marin County in California, where he had caught the case for retaliatory action against the guard behind the murder of Fred Billingsley, who was beaten and tear gassed to death in his cell. These things were happening systematically behind the walls, and so brothers like George and Christmas and McLean were taking matters into their own hands and fighting back. So the August 7th, 1970, Jonathan, armed to the teeth, stormed the courtroom and tossed guns to Christmas and McLean. Rochelle McGee was in the courtroom to testify for McLean, and he joined spontaneously. The three four. There was a waiting van, and Jackson took as hostages the judge, the prosecutor, and three jurors, and headed for the van. And the plan was to get to a radio station to not only demand the release of the Soledad brothers, but also to expose the horrendous and horrific conditions that black prisoners were enduring at that time. So,
right.
But the prison guards arrived before the man could even pull out of the parking lot and shot up the van. Three brothers, Jonathan was shot point blank in the head. The two other brothers were killed, and Rochelle was seriously wounded. And the judge was killed, and the prosecutor was seriously wounded. One juror sustained a minor arm wound. And so, of course, Rochelle McGee, being the sole survivor, caught, you know, all the charges, even the murder charges, which eventually, of course, they had to throw out. He was originally on trial with Angela Davis, who was only guilty of purchasing the guns, because Jonathan Jackson had also served as her bodyguard. In the campaign to free the Soledad brothers, in which she was quite active. So and quite prominent. So she was a professor at one of the universities in California.
UCLA.
Yeah, because I know she's at another one now, or she last was at a different one. But Rochelle wanted a political trial, and she wanted her legal team wanted an expedient one, because she was innocent, and Rochelle, of course, was involved and wanted to conduct a trial that was based on the trial of Sinku, the famous case of the slave who revolted and on the ship Amistad and was brought to trial, and it became the classic case of whether or not a slave had the right to escape slavery, and in that case he was exonerated because they decided that a slave did have the right to escape slavery. So that's the basis on which Rochelle wanted to conduct his trial, and of course that wasn't going to happen with Angela, so their trials were separated. I actually was covering the pretrial hearings for the Sun Reporter,
Some reporter up in San Francisco, right? Yeah.
Yes, at the time. That was a black biweekly news. It still is a black biweekly. And so I got to meet Rochelle and started and began a correspondence. I got to talk to him in the holding cell and stuff with my press credentials. So Rochelle McGee, I would encourage people to try to communicate with him or send him some love, because he's doing his 51st year, and here's a brother who's really never hurt anybody. He's never murdered anybody or anything, but he was a jail. He's a famous
jailhouse lawyer, right?
Oh yeah, and they're hardest on the jailhouse lawyers. They don't like them at all. They give jailhouse lawyers the roughest time as a group in prison.
Rochelle is from near where I was born. I was born in Arcadia, Louisiana. Rochelle is from down there in that part of the world somewhere, I believe.
Franklinton.
Yeah. That's in
Franklinton.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Yeah, he was an only child, and when they captured him first in Louisiana, in Franklinton, it was for going out, befriending a white girl or dating a white girl or something, and it was Ku Klux Klan territory. So they charged him with, listen to this, aggravated attempted rape, whatever that is.
And whatever that is, right.
At 16 years old, he was thrown in Angola, the infamous slave plantation Angola, and an adult prison as a teenager. And he had to do 8 years, and his mother passed away while he was in prison, probably broke her heart. And they had property, and they confiscated it because they banished him, wouldn't let him go home, and forced him to leave the state and go to L.A., which is why he happened to be in California. 6 months later, on a little marijuana charge or something, they beat the hell out of him, put him in the hospital, and charged him with a bunch of stuff. And he was fighting that case when he attempted, you know, an illegal incarceration when he attempted to escape along with the other brothers. So he felt like he really had a case in terms of trying to escape slavery, because he had no business being in prison in the first place. But he's now done 51 years.
Pardon me. I would encourage everybody to go just Google and listen to his listen to him speak, because he's articulate and he can really handle himself in terms of the legal arguments. But we wanted to continue with George and, Jonathan
right.
George and Qatari.
Right. George Jackson, I know his case very well. I'm not that familiar with Qatari, except to know that he was killed, I believe, in around 78 or something. But I'm not sure what the exact, it was in the 70s. And he was one of the soldiers in behind the walls. And he was injured on the yard and hospitalized, and then he mysteriously turned up dead. So they believe that he was murdered also and martyred because of his political activity behind the wall. Now George,
It was because of him. That's why Black August started. I mean, because I guess they chose him to. It started at the year of a year after he was killed, I believe.
Right. Yes. It was. That was like, you know, the proverbial spark that starts the prairie fire. But it was
right.
It was essentially to, by that time, it was like, hey, wait a minute, you know, they're killing all our freedom fighters. So, but of course, George George had been his leader as well. And the field lieutenant of the Panther chapter behind the walls. So, and George had written two books. One was published posthumously or shortly after his death, and the first book was the book I met him through, because I was in New Haven, Connecticut, in the party in the chapter there, working and as both a Panther and a legal secretary to the defense, the lawyers for Bobby and Erica and Lonnie McLucas. So. Bottom line is I read Soledad Brother and felt a kindred spirit with George and began a correspondence. And then I came out here and got involved in, I was planning to get involved in his defense, and he actually invited to pay my way out here, but I didn't need that. and so I declined. But when I got out here, you know, he had indicated, and I remember the phrase chaos out here, and I said, yeah. But when I got out there, there was chaos. So things were kind of falling apart out here. And, you know, this was in the wake of the split that had been orchestrated by the FBI's infamous counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO. And, you know, we were under heavy surveillance and wiretapping and all that. In fact, I was a plaintiff in, among many, many others, in a wiretap lawsuit they called New Haven Wiretap City. So, but, you know, we couldn't win a lawsuit today because you wouldn't even have a case, because today they can surveil you, tap your phone, monitor you 24/7, you know, monitor every keystroke on a computer, and with impunity. There's no recourse. It's perfectly legal for them to invade our privacy these days. But
you're listening to Dire Spork Music on Uhuru Radio. I'm online with Kito and Yasha, and we're talking about the origins of Black August, and we were 78. Qatari was killed, so I guess Black August started in 1979. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey Qatari Golden. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I'm writing his son right now.
Mm-hmm.
His son is in prison. It's a shame how these things are cyclical now. You know, the
well, Bunchy Carter's brother is still in, I think he's in Pelican Bay in the youngest Carter, he's in prison
surprising.
Too.
I know. Yeah, that's what they're doing, locking us up, mass incarceration, get rid of us, don't let any more black babies be born, because it's separating men from the women, you know, I mean, it's taking away our reproductive years from us, and it's unbelievable. It's genocidal. We see it. We see the targeting of black men on our streets. You know, you can't even keep up with the number of murders now that are going down, of men and women. You know, it's unbelievable. And yet people are still acting as if nothing's going on, you know, and the police state is here, as George once said. Glaring, it's not coming, it's here. Glaring and threatening, he said. And another thing he said a long time ago, he said, fascism has temporarily succeeded under the guise of reform. And he was so right, because all you hear about is campaign finance reform, and what has that done? It's just gotten more fascist. We heard it when Clinton was in office, he was talking about welfare reform, and then what was that? It was removal of the safety net. And the building of more prisons, because he backed up, you know, subsidized states. They'll build all the prisons you want, states, and the feds will subsidize them. So they did. And that was the real beginning of the massive incarceration that we see now. And there's like 2.5 million prisoners in locked up, and another 6 or 7 million or more under some other form of penal control, you know, with the ankle thing or the parole or probation or whatever.
Can we talk about the whole question of internationalism and the fact that African people in North America, basically, if it hadn't been for, one, our own resistance, and two, the international support, we probably would have been wiped out already, because you know, the world knew about our struggle. And one of the things, no matter what you think about Dr. Martin Luther King, when he took all of those butt kickings, he basically says, "I'll take the butt kicking, but I want the German cameras to be here. I want the Japanese cameras to be here, so they can see, basically pointing out the contradictions." And George talked about how we needed international allies, and you know, and I was looking at Facebook a few moments ago, and I see that the Palestinians are coming out talking about what's taking place in Ferguson. Can you talk about the need for international support for any struggle, especially the struggle of black people in North America?
Oh, hell yeah. George was really, really clear on international in internationalism. I mean, he talked about, okay, one of the things, I have a quote right here. International capitalism cannot be destroyed without the extremes of struggle. The entire colonial world is watching the blacks inside the U.S., wondering and waiting for us to come to our senses. Their problems are and struggles with the American monster are much more difficult than they would be if we actively aided them. We are on the inside. We are the only ones left, ones besides the very small white minority left, who can get at the monster's heart without subjecting the world to nuclear fire. We have a momentous historical role to act out if we will. The whole world, for all time in the future, will love us and remember us as the righteous people who made it possible for the world to live on. And then he goes on to say, and this is really important, I don't want to die and leave a few sad songs and a hump in the ground as my only monument. I want to leave a world that is liberated from trash, pollution, racism, nation-state wars and armies, from pomp, bigotry, parochialism, 1,000 different brands of untruth, and licentious, usurious economics. So the bottom, and then one of the things he makes it clear to black people, the blanket indictment of the white so-called race has done nothing but perplex us, inhibit us. The theory that all whites are the immediate enemy and all blacks are brothers, making them loyal, is silly and indicative of a lazy mind, to be generous, since it could be a fascist plot. It doesn't explain the black pig. There were 6 on the Hampton Clark kill, meaning Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in Chicago in 69. It doesn't explain the black paratroopers, just more pigs, who put down the great Detroit, he says, riot, I would say rebellion. And it doesn't explain the pseudo-bourgeois who can be found almost everywhere in the halls of government working for white supremacy, fascism, and capitalism. And boy, do we have plenty. We have a black president in the halls of government working for white supremacy, fascism, and capitalism. And we can see that now clearly, because here's a guy who sits down every Tuesday and decides who's going to be targeted for assassination. Who's flying drones over Africa, North Africa, and the Middle East. So let me say this before
we run out of time. We have about 8 minutes,
know.
But I remember interviewing Malefi Asante one time, and Malefi Asante, I was talking about the fact that George. You know, George wanted to learn, he talked about wanting to learn Chinese, Arabic, Swahili, and wanting to live in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. And, you know, Malefi Asante basically says that George Jackson was, he didn't put him in the tradition of the great black leaders. He just says George was a Marxist, as if that was a minus. And I told some young people about that. And, you know, Malefi Asante, but he's problematic, but I just wanted to throw that out there.
Well, yeah, you know, I've had a lot of problems, and I wrote a paper, and it's on my blog. You can find it. And my blog is just my name, plus blogspot.com. But this black, you know, even Jonathan said, he says, I think I hate these black folks worse than, I'm paraphrasing, I hate the sheriff. And the reason is because, I mean, here you, for example, the perfect example is Obama. I mean, this dude has pacified the front lines of struggle.
He put us back to sleep, didn't he?
Oh my God, he has turned the clock back so far. It's horrible because we black people have always been on the front lines of struggle. It's socially scientific, and that's all Marxism means, is that when somebody says they're a Marxist, that means they're a social scientist, that they look at social things scientifically, social phenomenon scientifically, logically, dialectically. So here's the bottom line. We have the most, according to Marxism, the most oppressed will always be in the front line because we have not the least to lose and the most to gain from a change. And so we've always been on the front lines of struggle. And we have been so pacified that it's mind-boggling what they can get away with, and we're just, oh, la, 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 because Obama, we have a black president. La, la, la. Oh, he's not doing it because blah, blah, blah. They're making excuse after excuse after excuse. And we used to have a saying in the party, excuses are like blank holes. Everybody's got one. Okay? I didn't want you to have to believe it. but this dude stands up there. He said the most ridiculous thing the other day. He's standing up there and he's talking about this poor guy whose head was chopped off, right? This journalist, right? But in that context, he's talking about if any American citizen is killed, we will go after them, blah, blah. We will not rest until justice is done. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically, you heard that, didn't you? It was repeated ad nauseum, right?
And went all over the world.
I said to myself, well, isn't Michael Brown an American citizen?
That's right.
Hello?
Mm-hmm.
Think about it.
That's right.
But oh, Kilo, we'll go after them.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I basically want to thank you for coming on the show and concluding Black August. And definitely want to, I like to remind people of George at least once a year, but I deal with George all the time, and I'm a comrade of Kumasi, and
love Kumasi. How's he doing?
The last time I talked to Kumasi, he was doing all right. I had sent him a message about this new book that Gerald Horn had put out on a race to Cuba, and it's a very excellent book about the Cuban revolution and the relationship of black people in America and Cuba. And one of his theses in the book is that many of us, that is people born in America, you know, we have Cuban ties because, you know, they kept on taking blacks from the United States to Cuba back and forth. And it's a great book, but Kumasi is doing quite well.
Oh, good. Do I have enough time to read one of George's, leave people with one of his finest quotes?
We only have 3 minutes and 2 minutes, really.
I could do it in 30 seconds.
Beautiful. Go ahead.
Freedom means warmth and protection against harsh exposure to the elements. It means food, not garbage. It means truth, harmony, and the social relations that spring from these. It means the best medical attention whenever it's needed. It means employment that is reasonable, that coincides with the individual necessities and feelings. We will have this freedom even at the cost of total war.
Thank you, Kilo and Yasha. I would like to thank Lisa Watson for teching the show, and we will bring you back, Kilo. And I'd like to say to everyone, we will see you in the whirlwind. And once again, thank you, Kilo and Yasha.
Thank you, Norman, and power to the people.
All right. And Lisa, let's go with John Coltrane and Eric Dolphy. We will see you in the whirlwind. Take care.